Okay. My name is Sonny Rawlings. My full name is James Presley Rawlings, Jr. I was born in Bath County on November the 26th, 1944. I have two sisters, Mary Jo Kane, who lives in Flemingsburg. She has six children. I have Janelle Sue Beck, who lives in Bath County, has no children. And one brother, Larry Rawlings, who lives in Albany, Georgia. My parents were James Presley Rawlings, who was called Presley all of his life, and Atha Snediger Rawlings. Both are deceased. My father passed away in 1990. My mother passed away in 1986.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a tenant farmer. He was born in Fleming County, and back in those days, born in 1910, I don't think an education was stressed as much. He went to the eighth grade. Always felt inferior because he didn't have an education. He was many times, as I was growing up, I remember his being upset because he didn't feel he was smart enough to get a job. My mother not only graduated high school, but she went one semester at Morehead State, and she was a teacher for one semester. You could become a teacher after 1 year of college in those days. She always regretted that she quit to get married and raise a family, and that she didn't continue with her education. She later became a cafeteria cook in the school system. I remember in 1958 when she started, her pay was $20 a week, $4 a day for the 5 days in the school. She at that time could ride the school bus with us and ride home on the school bus as we came home from school. Dad later on in life became a timekeeper for the county road department. But he was sort of forced into that because my brother and I did most of the farming. We would stay out of school to help with the crop that had to be done. And he would not in any way stop us from going on to get a college education. So when we had the opportunity to go to Korea, he insisted that we go. Since he couldn't handle the farming, he had to retire and had to find something. And it gave him a lot of confidence as well. He found that he wasn't stupid, it was just that he didn't have the education. And he could overcome some of those things later on.
I'm not familiar with this term. What is a timekeeper do? I've never heard of that.
He kept the hours of the road crews. When the snows came, like we're in the winter time right now, if there was a heavy snow coming, they would call in crews to start putting salt on the roads. And he would keep the hours that all the men had worked and do the scheduling for them. So he turned in the hours worked during the week. They worked overtime, and he had to calculate their pay for their overtime pay.
Okay. To go back to what you said at the beginning, you said you didn't live in Kentucky for 10 years. Where did you live then?
Well, I lived in Kentucky. There was 10 years that I didn't live in Kentucky. I didn't live in Bath County for 15. I actually, in 1962, started college at Berea. And it was really one of the first times I lived more than a week away from home. Like go to FFA camp or something. I went to Berea, and because I changed my major, it took me 4.5 years to get my degree. I started out in mathematics and found that my background in math was too weak. At the time I went to school here in Owensville, they only had 3 math classes available, and they weren't available all of the time. I started out with Algebra 1. My sophomore year, geometry was offered, and I took geometry in my sophomore year out of fear that it would not be offered before I graduated. And then my junior year, I took Algebra 2, and that was it. The only other math course offered was for those that could not, didn't make a high enough score in the 8th grade. I even tried to get them to let me take that, and they wouldn't. So when I got to Berea, I didn't, because my last name started with an R, I didn't get into the class schedules. Had to skip having math the first semester. Second semester I went into math, and the professor was a Cuban refugee from the Cuban Missile Crisis named Dr. Prieto. And I sat in a class of integrated algebra and trig, listening to someone speak in broken English, and I'm not sure I would have understood it totally if he had been speaking hillbilly, as I would say around here. And I decided at that time to change my major. I found the things that I really enjoyed. At any rate, after I graduated, I stayed in Berea for another year and a half and went to California. I lived in Southern California, Orange County, south of Los Angeles, for the majority of the 10 years I did, with the exception of maybe a short 6 months in Texas.
You say you went to Berea. Do you think it's changed over the years?
Berea College?
Yes.
Yes, it has. My freshman year, I paid $280 for the entire semester. The only thing that that did not include was the cost of my books. The $280 paid for 3 meals a day the entire semester. It paid for my room, plain linen, every week. I had to take care of my laundry. But if I had the sniffles or wanted to see a doctor, I could walk to the college hospital, which at that time they owned. It included all the basketball games free, any sporting events. It included a free movie every week for that $280. We had to work for 10 hours a week at that time, and I started out as a bellhop at Boone Tavern Hotel. And I made 15 cents an hour. And we were content with that. Due to some laws and regulations that changed, sophomore year it suddenly went to $1 an hour, and we had a newfound wealth. I can honestly say I had $40 a month coming in. And I didn't know what to do with all of it. I didn't have anything to spend it on, because everything was taken care of. Today, I was talking to a student recently, the cost for a semester is about $1,500. But with Pell Grants, with the work and the work pay has increased. I think they're keeping it fairly close to minimum wage. You have Pell Grants, you have work, and you have scholarship funds that are available that most students end up with about $500 a semester as a cost.
Okay, to go back to the list of topics you gave us on the phone that you wanted to talk about, and the first one was about life in the 50s. How do you think life in the 50s is different from life today? Lifestyles today?
For the most part, I think there's a little bit more pride. It's hard to compare the times. First, I remember people talking about the war, because they're talking about World War II. I barely remember, I didn't even realize that the Korean conflict was going on. I remember when Eisenhower was elected and was running for president. In fact, I even remember one of the political jokes at the time, which was, why did the Democrat kill his dog? The guy didn't answer, he just said, well, when he stepped on his tail, he ran off yelling, Ike, 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 Ike. It was simpler. We had a 48 Chevy that was our family car for years. In fact, it was a cause of my not having a driver's license for a year after I was eligible. It wouldn't pass inspection. You didn't buy cars every whip stitch. You didn't have money. I remember worrying about whether or not we would have clothes or things like that. I remember really wanting to work at a job so I could buy clothes so that my parents didn't have to. And to some extent, I felt like I was a burden. In later years, I found out at one point my parents even considered asking me to go to town school for a little while so they could catch up on some bills and stuff. And yet, at the same time, we were happier. I feel like that I'm about 10 years behind the average person my age, because I can remember living in houses without electricity. I can remember listening to the battery-operated radio, and we're not talking about the little transistor jobs. We're talking about a bigger radio that it took a lot of money to buy a battery for. And listening to radio programs, that was the highlight. And then you had to be very selective because we didn't want to run the batteries down. I remember the first television I ever saw. And its screen was no bigger than what you would see on an oscilloscope, if you're familiar with that instrument now. It was only about 5 or 6 inches in diameter. There was so much that was possible that we didn't even realize how much change, how many changes were possible. Nickel L8s were on, people would go nuts about it. The bottle costs more than nickel today. I look at them as times that I have learned a lot. It wasn't until I got to college that I lived in homes that were, I lived in a place that was comfortable. At Berea, I probably was never, it was the first time that I had really felt secure, more comfortable than I ever felt at all. I didn't look through the wall and see daylight in the wintertime. That the wind was blowing in, or have to get up to put coal in the stove to keep warm. 50s were hard, but we had pride. I remember people begging my parents to go to the state for relief, and they would have nothing to do with it. I'm proud of going through the 50s. And I think most of the people had pride at that time. I don't see, it concerns me that I think there's less pride today. Part of it may be the Vietnam era, the disenchantment from the 70s and 60s. And I think as a result of that, it's part of why Japanese products are beating American products in many ways in quality. It's not that Americans are not capable, or that they can't. They haven't had enough pride to do it.
Okay. What significant events have you witnessed through experiences in newspapers, etc., and how do you feel about them?
I remember several things that have happened. I think that I'll always remember. For example, in the seventh grade when I heard about Sputnik, and I had no idea what Sputnik was, that it was even a possibility. And I had no idea why in the world anybody would want to have a little silver ball going around the earth, whether they were Russian or American. But it started the space race. And that later on was to have an impact on my life. I recall in 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated. I was at Berea, I was right at class change. As I was leaving a philosophy class to go to a science class, in the next building, I heard someone say that the president had been shot. I was all packed to come home to visit for the weekend. It was on that Friday. I was going to leave right after the science class. We sat in the science class, and the girls were crying. Somebody had a radio and we were listening as the president was pronounced dead. There was a lot of questions about what would happen because just a short while before, and looking back, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I saw students up and leave college because they felt the world was going to come to an end. We were going to get bombed. Which was all back from the era that we had people building bomb shelters just back in the 50s out of fear of the bomb. It was always the bomb. I don't think any of us realized how much stronger they would be and how things, how bad things could be if a bomb were actually dropped. That had an impact, and then a few years later, as I was driving to, as I was trying to save money to go to California, I decided to go at that time. I worked two jobs to pay off some bills, ended up with pneumonia, and I was laying on the couch with pneumonia, trying to recover from that when word came out about Martin Luther King being shot. And then when later on that year when we went to California, I had spent the night in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They're on just following Route 66, and I always got up early in the area. It is sunrise, and it had happened during the night in L.A. on the way out. Those were times that there was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of Vietnam War building up. My first job in California was a manufacturing engineer associate. Basically, it just meant that I helped a manufacturing engineer. I did a lot of engineering work. But of all the things I was to do, it was in a munitions plant. The company I worked for did a lot of other things, including building the framework for the Boeing 747, which had not been flying yet. that we built the framework for that at the main plant. Our plant was off to the side, a few miles away. No signs, security up, and they were always afraid the protesters would be marching outside. Protesters marched outside the main buildings. They didn't know where we were. And that was where we were assembling the 2.75 rocket warhead and the shell canisters that were all being used in Vietnam. We made the shrapnel, or the flechettes that went into the casing. We tested the warhead in the plant. It began to bother me as to what it was doing to people because these bombs did not discriminate. When they fired one of these shells into an area, whoever was there was going to be gone. And then I started seeing some of the designs that I can't even talk about today of future weapons that bothered me even more. Fortunately, the Vietnam War ended real soon. At that time, I enjoyed being part of the Apollo missions. I was working for Northrop at the time. Man who first walked on the moon, which evolved from Sputnik. And took pride in the fact that we built the landing system for the Apollo series as it came down. It was our company's parachute system that slowed it down in the reentry so that they didn't splatter in the ocean. These events have all, as far as history, have had an impact in my life. And I can't think of anything right offhand that probably has had more of an impact or has presented more trauma one way or another.
What about the Saudi Arabia war? How did that, was that anything like the other ones to you?
No. The Saudi Arabia situation was one that was totally different from Vietnam. I've often said that, and I knew that a lot of people would probably hate me for saying it, but Americans needed something to wake them up, to get them excited, to get them united. Because in many, many ways, I feel that the name, that the United States is a misnomer. I think that there was hope when we had the Desert Storm operation, because I saw more people united, regardless of what their beliefs or their religions or their race was. We were all together as one. And I think that's what it's going to take for us to pull out of it economically, to be able to outproduce other countries. And I think that unless, due to the increased communications and speed of transportation, unless we can compete in the world market and forget all of our petty squabbles, we will go down even further, because we have to compete not internally, but we have to compete worldwide. And as long as somebody can outproduce us, for whatever reason, whether it's attitude or slave labor, we're going to have a problem.
Since we're on the subject, what do you think about troops in Somalia?
I think that I think it's a good thing. I'm not sure of all the details. I in the years that I've lived, I've found that you never know all of the details in the situation. You know what the news media is willing to report or what information they're allowed to release. I don't think we should condone the suffering that is going through there. But I also realize that you're getting into dangerous ground, because it's sort of like if you're a Star Trek fan, the prime directive is not to disrupt the natural order of things. And I'm not suggesting that we should let children starve. But where do you stop in correcting the war? We could easily take over all of it and say, okay, no more fighting. But how much is that going to change them or the history? Or is it going to be the best for them eventually?
You also wish to talk about industry. What is your background in industry?
I have, number one, a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Arts Technology that got me into the job as an engineer for Northrop. After the Vietnam War ended and the engineers were a dime a dozen in Southern California then, I went back to Cal State Fullerton and got a degree in business administration with a concentration in industrial management. From that point, I worked as a production planner, material control supervisor, a traffic manager, quality control manager, and a production superintendent. Before I came back, the industries that I had worked in varied from making automotive parts to working with mobile homes to being in the paper industry. So it is extremely varied, most of it in industrial production, quality control, and getting the proper flow of parts and coordinated.
What kind of changes have you noticed over the
years? In manufacturing, I've seen a lot of changes in the unionization and the way plants work. When I graduated, you could literally walk out. In fact, I did. Two weeks before I graduated from Berea, I had a promise of a job with Ford Motor Company in Detroit. 2 weeks before I was to graduate, they had a cutback in the recession. Of course, training programs got cut back. So they said it would be a couple months before I could be brought on. I don't know whether it's ignorance or confidence, but I told them to not to bother calling back, that I owed money. I owed $1,300 then. $1,000 of it was for a car. The other $300 was for 4.5 years of college. But that I couldn't afford to be off work 2 months. So I graduated and started driving around Lexington, just stopping in at different plants. And I got a job the first day I was out looking. They gave me a test and told me to report back. This was on Monday, and told me to report back to work Wednesday. Show you how things have changed in Lexington. I didn't have any clothes to wear, so I walked into a store right on Main Street in Lexington and walked out with over $100 worth of clothes just on the promise of coming in and paying. Just told them I didn't have any money. They had never seen me before in my life. But getting back to the work, Square D had was unionized, and there was no problems there. When I had worked for Ford Motor Company in the summers, for 2 summers while I was going to school, I had witnessed a wildcat strike, and that was my first exposure to a strong union. Northrop wasn't unionized, but I worked for other companies that were. I'd worked for one company in which, when they had a strike, some of the girls that were on the picket line would hand lunch across the fence to a supervisor, and here he was supposed to be the enemy. But I saw a lot of changes where the union side and management side got emotional and forgot the objective. And in the end, no one won. I have seen more of that coming about to the point that I think unions have lost a lot of their power. They can blame past administration in Washington as much as they want. But it has evolved where they have become disinterested or lost the goal, lost sight of what they were originally about.
I guess computers have a lot to do with some of these changes. How do you feel about computers and the changes they have caused?
I think that an individual graduating from high school today that doesn't have knowledge about computers and feel friendly with them is going to be lost. Every job will have some computer influence. When I started, things were done by hand. PCs weren't even around. The computers that I was exposed to were humongous beasts that were kept in air-conditioned facilities. And now we've got laptops that will do more than these things with. I see it evolving to the point that jobs today are going to, number one, require a knowledge of computers. I don't care who you are or what you're doing. And number two, you're going to have to be able to change. I think that regardless of what career you're in, you're probably going to see more change faster than any generation has.
I'd like to ask a question now. You're talking about unions. Have you ever witnessed a violent strike?
Not a violent one. I've seen them where threats were made. I've seen them, in fact, where there were threats that that they would kill an individual that walked across the line way into work. I've taken part in some labor negotiating. When I worked at Kimberly-Clark as a superintendent, had to be a member of the standing committee, which was the level that grievances were discussed before it went on to arbitration. Are you familiar with the hierarchy in labor negotiations? Okay. It starts out when you've got an individual that is not happy with something that's happening. He feels aggrieved. So he files a formal complaint, much like an accident report. Then you turn around, the supervisor that was involved and the aggrieved individual and a union steward try to settle the situation. If they cannot come to an agreement, whether it is an apology or financial gain, then it goes on to a sometimes it will go on to a superintendent to step in for the supervisor. Sometimes it will skip straight on to what is called the standing committee. In the standing committee, you have the president of the union, plus about three or four representatives, and it's a mini arbitration, really, is what it amounts to. You'll have the operations manager, the superintendent involved, and possibly the supervisor. And it becomes a game in many aspects. What can I say to disrupt you? I've seen the union president drop a bombshell on the operations manager, maybe something totally different. Okay, getting back to the standing committee, the president of the union would say something to the operations manager, get him so distracted over something that had nothing to do with the grievance, that they would use it as a tactical advantage to try to win the grievance. If the standing committee didn't come to an agreement, then it went from there to arbitration. And arbitration is where outside individuals, attorneys and otherwise, would make a decision on what was right or wrong. But that cost both sides money. When I came to work for A.O. Smith, I was amazed that the union there had never won an arbitration. They continued to send them out. And I have always felt that if you're doing something right in a situation like that, you're sending you're going to win at best 50% of the cases you send. If you win all of them, your union is pushing the wrong grievances, or they're settling the wrong grievances out of court, so to speak, before they get to arbitration. If you're losing all of them, management's doing the same thing. It should be a case when both sides would win 50%. And I think these things have weakened the unions in that some of them did get emotional. They would pick things that did not go along with the labor law as we know it.
Regulations will government change the industry?
It's changed it quite a bit. Punch presses, you used to could tell an individual had worked where there were punch presses around because they would have fingers missing. And it was quite frequent that I'd go into a new plant or a facility or an older operating facility. You could always tell the individuals that had worked in the old days, the long times, they had parts missing. OSHA, in many ways, was hated because they came in, it was like an outsider coming in and saying, you can't do this, you've got to do this, and putting, in some cases, it seemed unreasonable demands. But I can't argue with what they were trying to do, in that it was for the general safety of the employee and others involved. Some of the first mechanisms were hilarious. I've seen a pipe that would swing in front of the punch press as the die was coming down. If your arms were in the way, they were going to get broken. You may keep your fingers, but you're going to have broken arms. I've seen them with the double buttons, where both hands had to hit a button for the punch press to operate. And those were generally the best, as long as the employee did not take one of them down. They have become sophisticated now to the point that employees don't have to worry about or can't do that as much. The problem is, though, to totally promote employee safety, going to computerized machines. Robots might get their arms cut off, but if a program goes wrong, but it's not like a family member losing part of his body. So I can see why robots are going into it. You don't have to pay them overtime. You don't have to. And yet there's nothing we can do to stop this. We can complain all we want to. Just like the blacksmith did when the automobile came around. And this is what I was referring to earlier, about the two things an individual starting out today has to know, and that's computers and the ability to change. Because robots and computers are going to take place whether we want them to or not. They will change our jobs. And you will have to re-educate yourself and keep abreast of what is happening in your futures.
Do you think robots are going and computers are going to take over the industry? Will there still be places for humans?
There will always be places for humans because, after all, a computer, to oversimplify it, you might say the computer is the dumbest machine in the world. It can't do a thing unless you tell it to, or someone tells it to. And you might as well be the one to tell it. The person that is going to be trained enough to be able to tell that machine what to do is will be safe. The one that shies away from it is going to be doing some menial task somewhere else. And I don't think they will take over industry as we know it. There's a natural evolution as things go along. Things are going to change.
Okay, going back to this assassination of President Kennedy, how did it affect you?
It affected those around me, and it gave me, personally, I was in shock, to believe that it could happen here. This was something that happened in other countries, not in the United States, not since Lincoln. Of course, there were other assassinations, but Lincoln was the one that everybody knew about. It gave you a sense of insecurity that an awakening that things can happen. And there were reruns that reminded you of it. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, it wasn't quite as much of a shock, but it was still a reminder it could happen. Or when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And you never were in your dream world of being untouchable after that.
Okay. Go ahead. A lot of books and movies are being made about the Kennedys. Do you believe all this gossip that's going around about them?
No. It can be true, it may not be true. I don't think anyone can prove it either way. It's like the second shot theory, the puff of smoke from the hillside in Dallas. I don't think that we will ever know anything more than we do now. The participants are all gone. It was always, that was the thing that always bothered me and probably spurred a lot of the questions. Why was Lee Harvey Oswald shot so fast afterwards? And did Jack Ruby really die of cancer? I mean, all we have is what somebody else says. And the credibility, I guess through the years, the credibility of politicians and the press have gone way down. In the 50s, I might have believed everything I read. Today, I believe very little. I think the press can control what we think and what we do, whether it is a presidential election or war. And I'm not even saying that it is a concerted effort. In some cases it may be. But if we listen to someone saying something long enough, we will eventually believe it ourselves, whether it's the economy is bad or whatever.
Good question.
Yeah.
Earlier you stated that you thought Americans weren't united until Saudi Arabia. Do you think that the press manipulated us into being united? Or do you think that that would have happened sooner or later? Like you're talking about the press.
The press had a hand in it, but not as much. I think that the Saudi Arabia situation, in comparison to Somalia, I think it is ludicrous to have reporters on the beach with their lights as the Marines are landing in their full gear and makeup. It is just, it's scary, to be honest about it. I don't think they would have even considered anything like that in Desert Storm.
It's kind of strange the press being there before the troops were, too.
Right. And that you begin to wonder what's going on. In the Desert Storm, I think they tried to report, they were left out to some extent. And I don't think they had quite as much control of it. I think basically it was just the Americans needed something to unite about. Every once in a while they need something to feel good about and to band together. I don't care whether you're a family or whatever, but we had more pride as Americans then. And we could have leaped tall buildings in a single bound if we were asked to. I still believe that firmly.
Well, on the subject of politicians, may I ask who you are in favor of in the election this year?
I was in favor of Bush, but I still had little hope that he would win because I also saw the winds of change, so to speak. The change I was talking about that happens in life will happen to politicians, industry, anything you look at. And I felt like that the change would take place this time. I've chuckled a little bit at how the newspapers have changed a little and some of the reporting. How suddenly the economy has changed since the election. And I'm not saying that it was because of Bush. I think things are going to happen. We determine what things are going to be. I think the press can determine what our economy is, as well as the politicians.
Okay. I'd like to go back again. Did the assassination of Martin Luther King affect you as deeply as President King's assassination did?
No. product of the 50s. Oh, and I have to admit, I wasn't anti-black, but you know, I went to school in Bath County for 12 years without a single black being in the school. That was before segregation. I am ashamed to say that I remember seeing restrooms marked whites only here in Kentucky, here in neighboring counties. I was in favor of a lot of things that Martin Luther King was doing. But I wasn't a participant. I was just one of these that would sit back and say, yeah, that he's right, that should be done. That didn't march. I didn't go down. So I think that was a product of being raised in the 50s in the South. Okay, I think she's ready.
Ask her first.
Okay, going back to Martin Luther King, how do you think that relates to today's ideas about racism and all that, especially with the LA riots and stuff? How do you feel about that? Do you think that those two events are related?
To an extent. I think that the LA riots probably would have occurred even if Martin Luther King hadn't been assassinated. I've been through Watts after the first riot. The thing that amazed me as I traveled around, and I'll use some of the ethnic phrases, but we all have our prejudices. In many ways, we each have to feel a little superior to someone else, one way or another, whether it's from a mental standpoint or a physical or whatever. And I think it's that way with the first time I was in Michigan, I was in the heart of Polack country, to use a term I shouldn't use probably, but Polack jokes were plentiful. And the Polacks were right there to fight about it. The Italian people were joked about at one time. I remember a lot of WAP jokes when I lived in different parts of the country. But when I went to California, the Beaners were the ones that were criticized. I mean, you had a community that was the size of the state of Kentucky there in Southern California, and the Mexican American was looked down upon, and he was there first. Actually, the Native American was there first.
Do you think that's because of the decline in American morale and attitude?
Well, the thing that I'm not sure about that. The thing that got me is that probably the most prejudiced were the Okies, the people that came from Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl, moving to California. And I looked at it as sort of an insecurity. And I've begun to look at all prejudices as a form of insecurity. It's sort of like playing King of the Mountain If you kick everybody else down, you can stay on top. And you kick the one that is the making you feel insecure. I've tried to judge, if I'm going to judge, tried to judge by the individual. When I was working in California, the employees that worked the hardest and did the best for me were what we called wetbacks. They weren't totally illegal aliens, they were green card. Some of them might have been illegal, I have no idea, because they went through the office. They did not speak English. They would do any job required. It didn't make a difference how dirty it was or how long it was. They needed the money. They would live as off as little as possible and send the rest to their families in Mexico. I've heard many stories where they would, the Border Patrol would come in and raid the plant. There would be a lot of people hiding, but they would take the illegal aliens, transport them 90 miles south to across the border, and they would be back to work within one working day. It would take them just that long to get back across the border to report back to work. And then I turned around and looked at the Chicanos. These were the young Mexican Americans with a chip on the shoulder. This is back in the Cheech and Chong era. And the ones that was going around, hey man, they were a little bit on the belligerent side. They were looking for you to take advantage of them and to fight it. Sometimes it wasn't there, sometimes it was. But I really didn't have, I had a hard time having total respect for them because of the chip on their shoulder. But, it taught me a lot about the prejudices of the South. It doesn't make a difference where you live. There are going to be prejudices, and I still feel that it is due to a basic insecurity.
Kentucky is in the deep South, but do you think prejudices are strong here and more strong here than the South?
Kentucky is mixed up. If you go in Tennessee and Georgia, Kentucky's Yankee country. If you go into to Michigan, we're South. We were on the Union side, if you look at the map. And I think that Kentucky was one of the areas where you had brother against brother situation. But at the same time, I think the Confederates and the South made an effort to put up more Confederate memorials throughout the country. And I don't recall very many Union memorials around Kentucky. Almost every cemetery has a Confederate memorial somewhere. And I think for that we still think of ourselves as South. In reality, we weren't.
How does Kentucky compare with other states in education and industry?
Stereotype or actual?
Actual.
Stereotype, of course, is pretty bad. Actual might be a little bit better. I think that we have been behind the times. There is a world out there that so many of us haven't seen or dreamed of. And I think that education reform, if given a chance, may make a difference. I don't question the intelligence of the students. We have some very intelligent people, but there are many of them that haven't had an opportunity for that education. I think it's appalling, like when I went, that we only had 3 math classes. To an extent, I think it's appalling that it's only been just this, 2 years now that we've even had any form of calculus. I think that there are so many things in so many areas we can go into. And I personally feel that education would be much better if we could, number one, show how it is can be used or will be used later on. And I think we need to get excited about learning, about why we're doing it. I hear an awful lot of gripe from students and teachers. And I feel that you can get an education. Education can be gained anywhere if you want. But if you have a good school system, it makes it a lot easier. You can get an education from Morehead or Berea, or you can get a degree from either one, and they're not the same.
Okay, so I
take it you think the Education Reform Act is going to
work? If there is enough effort. Do you think it will be good effort?
Time will tell. I think that there's a lot that do not like it. None of us like change. And yet, that is probably the most consistent thing I can state about life is, as far as the future. There will be change. And I think that's going to have to take place, regardless of whether it's education, or your life, or your workplace.
Okay. So, going to another subject. When we were talking about the 50s, you mentioned radio programs.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite?
I liked, I remember listening to Gene Autry. When I was milking a cow, we had, I was only about to the second grade, first or second grade, but we had a cow that we tied in the fence, and I learned to milk the cow. I would have the radio out the window and I could listen to Gene Autry from there. The Lone Ranger was there some. The programs, probably one of my favorites was the Shadow. It was sort of a mystery. And he had a laugh that I later learned to imitate. But then there was the Great Gildersleeve. And Fibbermeade and Molly. And there are stories that probably are programs your grandparents. I remember my mother listening to soap operas. There was Stella Dallas and The Life of Belle. There were two that I remember. She would listen to in the afternoons.
Of course, Stevie changed all that. What do you think about radio and television now?
Well, in some ways, I think that that TV has ruined us. There used to be a time, I think, that you could be doing other things while you were listening to the radio. I think that because there were fewer programs, you found more creative ways of using their time, whether it was trying to make something or studying or reading. Very few people can read with television on because the eyes are going to be looking at the set. I tried it as a student, I know. And I think it is monopolized. I think myself, I probably would have been much more productive and creative if television didn't exist.
Pause. How do you feel since when you left Kentucky and then you came back? How do you feel that the land, the people, just everything in general has changed? What's the biggest turnaround from your point of view?
I don't think the land has changed tremendously. It's pretty much as I remember it. It had been 15 years since I lived in the county when I came back. So it was like they moved in a whole new set of people. My first month or two around, I was afraid I was going to run into a high school classmate and not recognize them. And I see a lot of the basic things from people that I knew before. That are still around. They haven't really changed that much. But there's a whole new set of people that I didn't know existed. Some of them were around and I was isolated. So I was growing up because we didn't travel completely all over the country or the county. I repeat what I said before. I feel like that there's less pride from the individual as far as who you are, and pride of a work ethic or what you can do. We seem to have, all of us in many ways, more willing to give up and let somebody else do it.
You think that decline in pride and stuff is why the library is going kind of down the drain? What do you think about that?
I think that that is part of it. We have a group of people that do not use the library, and they don't care, for the most part. We have those that do use it, that are fighting for it. And we have those that are afraid they're going to have more taxes come upon them, and they're looking at it as dollar signs. And they're not in favor of it that way.
It used to be that families together with like corn husking and Saturday night dances and stuff in town. Do you think that because we don't have that community closeness, that's kind of why everybody's drifting apart and a lot of conflicts occur?
That might be. Now, I wasn't involved too much in the Saturday night dances and stuff. The big event is when we came to Owingsville to do our shopping and on Saturday afternoon. And everybody would be walking the streets to find out how so-and-so is and what's going on. The big social events I remember outside of the family were getting together to play a high five for the card game on maybe one night, a month, in the summer or on occasion. Or there might be a fish fry. My father and some of his friends would go fishing, and then once they had enough fish, they'd get about ready for fish fry and card game. And the adults would play cards, and all of us kids would run around like a bunch of wild Indians all over the place out in the farm country. But now we don't have the closest. here again, I think we're preoccupied by what's on TV.
Too busy to take time out to show.
Yeah, how many people talk when the UK is playing? Not many, I guarantee. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that when halftime comes, the water pressure here at Orangeville has got to drop a tremendous amount from everybody flushing the commode all at the same time.
While we're discussing Blackberry, how do you feel about the recent visit of primetime Blackberry? Do you think it accurately represented Blackberry?
No, I don't really think it does. I think that we had some farmers on there. And then they went to show some of the extreme poverty. And there was the there was some implication of possible fraud there, I don't know, or why the system was failing. And the individuals that see that are going to see farmers and poverty. They're not going to see the education, the educated individual. They're not going to see a teacher. They're not going to see just a rural community as a I think the primetime broadcast is like the, you could make an analogy of the blind man looking at the elephant and feeling just one part of it and trying to determine what it wants. And there's no way that that broadcast typified Bath County. I think Bath County has much more to offer. And could offer much more. I've often said that if we could make Bath County a retirement village and resort area, it may become what it should. I know that with tobacco going out, and it will eventually. We have a lot to offer. We've got the lake, we've got the mountains, we've got land that is ideal for golf courses, and I've even had visions of like a large farm that was built for people to take vacations. They could come in and ride horses and or go boating or golfing and forget the cares of the world. And there is a need for that. There's a need for an area to retire to. I saw individuals in California that bought homes in the 50s and when they reached retirement could not afford to pay the taxes on those homes because the taxes far exceeded what the payments ever were. The land had appreciated so much, so fast. Values here are minuscule in comparison. And that you could benefit several people by having this as a retirement home or a retirement area.
Okay, to wrap it up, we've talked about changes that have happened in the past. What changes do you see happening in the future? What improvements do you see?
I'm fascinated with the changes in the surgery techniques. The fact that gallbladder surgery can be done without the incision going all the way across the abdomen. I think that with the computers, with it's beyond our imaginations. I think that we will eventually find new fuel sources. The ozone layer I'm not sure about how much of an impact it's going to have. I still can't imagine this as being a tropical area and being all hot throughout the year. But it's beyond imagination. I remember when the laser first came out in 62, and all I could do was turn a diamond into smoke. How it went from being depicted as a Buck Rogers ray gun, which it may eventually be if they can solve the power supply problem, to being something to do surgery with the eyes or internally. We could never have dreamed of those things. I think the thing that I look forward to are the possibilities, the things that you can't even think of. Maybe I'm a dreamer to start with. We'll have gadgets that probably in our mind it's impossible that we'll be around. I used to read science fiction and think of cars that would go without wheels, or cars that would go on an interstate completely automated. They never really came to that. But eventually somebody might. I think probably rather than being a car that's totally automated, it may be a completely different form of transportation. Whether it's the Star Trek transporter system or whatever. Anything is possible. And I envy those people who will be around to see it. Thank you.
Thank you.